Welcome back, children of the revolution, to Ace of Spades, PDX.com, and the audio educational and anthology series, What You're Not Listening To. I'm your host, show producer, webmaster, audio engineer, researcher, video promo producer, and writer, Daddy Ben Bear, Ben Brown Jr. And I never thought this day would come. 2 years ago, when my husband was having a quadruple bypass surgery, it was, wow. I have to say the following. Happy 25th anniversary to my husband, Travis. Here we are. Can you still believe it? My God, it seems like just a hot minute ago, right? And no other show could have come out today. Today, we're looking at Aerosmith ruling the 70s. Sex, drugs, rock and roll, amplified to 11 with the power of a freight train. For those who rabbit on about being a rock star, know that the Bad Boys from Boston wrote the book and then set it on fire. And a quick note, there is only one ballad in this program, but it's the original power ballad, so maybe that doesn't count. A few years ago, when my husband Travis and I were early in our relationship, I happened to be a member of Aerosmith's fan club, Aeroforce One. The band were having contests revolving around what would be the release of what I considered to be their best studio album of the 90s, Nine Lives in 97. Name Our New Album was a contest they were running. After talking to Travis about this, the first word out of his mouth in describing an Aerosmith song from their perspective was pussy. I added that the whole album would probably be more songs about pussy, and that is what we submitted. Needless to say, we didn't win, but we were awarded fourth row center stage tickets to their San Diego show in December. They were the first rock band to play a new arena in town. It was billed as Aerosmith at the Cox, C-O-X, in the newspaper, with a screaming cat as the image. I can't even make this up. Of the numerous times we had seen them, Travis in the 70s and myself in the 80s and 90s, it was by far the best performance either one of us had witnessed by the group. At the end of the night, after the band finished bluesman Tiny Bradshaw's Train Kept a Rollin', Aerosmith's version, of course, was heavily influenced by the Johnny Burnett Trio and Yardbirds covers of the song, lead singer Steven Tyler was heaving, as if he was almost about to collapse. Two non-stop solid hours of hits, album cuts, and covers. A whole lot of energy, speed, volume, and most importantly, fun. We both remember seeing Tyler smiling from ear to ear, knowing that Aerosmith had literally broken the venue's cherry that night. At the end of the month, the San Diego Union Tribune music editor, who was typically averse to anything loud or heavy, called it one of the 10 best live performances of the year. It wasn't always sunshine and roses, though. Starting out in 1970, playing at a high school gymnasium, Aerosmith were the hardest-working rock band of the decade. They opened for acts they would eventually outsell, including Rush, Queen, and Mott the Hoople. They were even on bills with banjo player Eric Weissman and opened for jazz fusion group the Mahavishnu Orchestra. And concerning Queen, because I know there's some rivalry there, Brian May, their guitarist, said the following, "There will never be a rock group more all-around great than Aerosmith." Thank you, sir. They were the last act signed to Columbia Records by legendary music mogul Clive Davis before he was fired from the label. Their first album was released on the same day as the debut album by Bruce Springsteen. According to the band in their best-selling autobiography from 1997, Walk This Way, for every $100 they spent on Springsteen, they spent a dollar on us. And for the record, in the 1970s, Aerosmith also outsold Springsteen. The band were also utterly hated by many in the so-called hip musical press as sloppy stone seconds, without even realizing they were blowing away the world's greatest rock and roll band at every conceivable turn. Sadly, sycophants seemingly surrounded the band as their stature grew in spite of the negativity from the establishment. Even Annie Leibovitz, the famed photographer, stalked the band in 1976, forced her way into a hotel they were staying in, woke up lead singer Tyler in the middle of the night, and offered him drugs just to get a photograph for the cover of Rolling Stone magazine, which at the time had never run one positive review of the group. She also lied and did not produce any illicit substances, but her photograph did grace the front cover of the publication. For all the talk about people wanting to be rock stars, they honestly don't have a damn clue what that era originally meant. It is the 21st century version of the myth of the Old West cowboy, redone with glamour and none of the sleaze or ear-splitting intensity. Yes, there was money in groupies, but there were also the aforementioned hangers-on, the girlfriends who fought with one another, the endless supply of yes-men providing an endless supply of drugs, the Lamborghinis wrapped around trees, $80,000 hotel bills, gun violence, managers stealing your money, constant negative press, record companies not supporting you, and paranoia so bad by everyone involved that no one had control. And for some unknown reason, fans would throw fireworks on stage, causing the band to erect a cyclone fence at shows. They toured the country endlessly, and not just major markets. Unlike many of the top name acts of the day, they were the band you could actually see live. Aerosmith were always made out to be the villain, literally, as they were in the absolutely dreadful film Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. Narrator George Byrne described the group's entrance into the movie in the following manner. The evil force that would poison young minds, pollute the environment, and subvert the democratic process. Just wow. Of course, it didn't stop many from wanting a piece of them. In spite of all this, or possibly because of it, Aerosmith were hated by being the single best rock and roll live band around, playing stadiums when artists given more stature by the mainstream were struggling to fill far smaller venues. Aerosmith delivered, plain and simple. Even Parliament Funkadelic used their sound system for the Mothership Connection tour. The original lineup eventually splintered over spilt milk. No, for real, that actually did happen. And it took years for them to claw their way up to the most impossible comeback that no one saw coming. Why would I even pick this act to celebrate my 25th anniversary? Darling, I only want the best because I goddamn deserve it. And so does my husband. Aerosmith or Aerosmith or Aerosmith, say whatever the hell you want, but as disabled gay men with AIDS who somehow survived and celebrate life as much as possible, there is no better soundtrack to our lives than a band that has gone through absolute hell and still comes out winning. Aerosmith is the playlist to our survivor history. Play it loud or get the hell gone, because as people in our 50s and 60s, we ain't got time to waste. Happy 25th anniversary to the single best thing that has ever happened to me. We're still here, we're still queer, and literally living the dream. And let's talk about sleaze for a moment, and I hope you guys are ready for this. Okay, you want to be rock stars? The first track in our survey comes from their second album called Get Your Wings from 1974. It's also the first one where Jack Douglas took a major production and engineering role with the band, and their sound improved dramatically from their debut. Get Your Wings? Okay, I was raised around bikers, so bear with me on this one. It meant you went down on your old lady when she was menstruating and you ended up with blood covered on your face. It's that disgusting. This is SOS Too Bad, and we'll see you in just about 30 minutes.
She would, she couldn't. Thank you.
And welcome back, Children of the Revolution, to what you're not listening to, the audio educational and anthology series here on Ace of Spades, PDX.com. I'm still Ben Brown Jr., Daddy Ben Bear. Happy 25th anniversary to my husband, Travis, and the only show that could have come out today, Aerosmith in the 70s. Oh, yes, I hope you are blowing some speakers. Let's recap what we've heard in the first part of our show, shall we? Kicked it off with SOS, Too Bad, from 1974's Get Your Wings. After that was the title track to 1977's Draw the Line, and you could really hear the band where things were really starting to fall apart on this album, even though it was a platinum seller, fell far below expectations. And according to Steven Tyler, the only lines they were basically drawing were the cocaine on a mirror. And how bad was Aerosmith's drug use during this period? Jerry Garcia said that Aerosmith were the druggiest bunch of people that the Grateful Dead ever saw. And for any of you who know anything about the Dead, their whole mythology is wrapped around psychedelics, hallucinogenics, and other drugs. Yes, that's, wow. Believe me, that's actually quite scary. After that, from their last studio album of the 1970s, from 79's Night in the Ruts. If you change the N and the R in the title, you understand what the original title was going to be. That is no surprise, which kind of tells the story of how Aerosmith formed. They even name-dropped Clive Davis, yes. And I know I'm probably going to ruffle some feathers here. I honestly believe Night in the Ruts is a much better album than Draw the Line. There you go. Following that was a studio outtake from 1972, On the Road Again. And if it sounds like Jug Blues Band music, it is, because it was written by John Sebastian of the Lovin' Spoonful, and it was an album track on their debut from 1965. Yes. And following that was the single A-side to 1978's Chip Away the Stone. Unfortunately, was not the commercial success the band hoped for. It's a fantastic single, but received a much bigger second life 10 years later when it was featured on a compilation called Gems. And following that, what else could that have been? With keyboard, you'll love this, bought with drug money stolen from a dealer. Because it's Aerosmith. From their debut album, Aerosmith, 1973's Dream On, a song, according to their autobiography, the band actually hated. But Steven persisted, and it made them superstars. So you have to understand that this song was released in 73, was a minor charted hit, and just like Lizzo has done recently, 3 years later, the record company released a single, became a top 10 smash and one of the defining songs of the decade. Very first power ballad. And interesting fun fact, because I love interesting fun facts. The Bic Lighter Corporation came out with their disposable in 1974, which was a mainstay and still is at Aerosmith shows to this day. Coincidence? I think not. And the song we just heard from their dark masterpiece, Rocks, from 1976, Sick as a Dog. Yes, baby, yes. It was what it was, and it was the 70s, Children of the Revolution. Alrighty, now, I hope you're ready for the next part of this. Yes, no, we're not going to be talking about bikers and menstruation at this moment. Let's hope we never have to again. And it's hard to believe now, especially when you see the charts now, where everything is, according to the Lev Volk's data compression model, which states that it looks for repetitiveness. More songs are repetitive on the charts now, and especially during the new millennium, than they ever have been in the past on the pop charts. They're also much slower. It's hard to believe now that this was a top 40 single, and it was the band's first top 40 single, especially considering what passes for a top 40 rock and roll band today. It's hard to believe that a song with this much firepower would actually get played on the radio next to, say, The Captain and Tennille. From their breakthrough album, Toys in the Attic, from 1975. This is Sweet Emotion, and we will see you at just before the grand finale.
cinch, but I really get her going. And then I get my, big 10-inch red band that plays the blues. Well, band that plays the blues. She just love my big 10-inch record of her favorite blues. Stop at jiving. No, whip out your big 10-inch record up. Band of players of blues. Well, band of players of blues. She just loves my big 10-inch record on my baby blues. I cup her with kisses. And when we in lovers clinch, she gets all excited. When she back on my big 10-inch record up. Band of players of blues. Well,
yeah.
And welcome back, Children of the Revolution, to our very special Aerosmith Ruling the 70s show here on What You're Not Listening To, the Audio Educational and Anthology Series, and happy anniversary, 25 years to my husband, Travis. Oh, man. There is no success like living well, right? Let's recap what we've heard in the second part of our program, shall we, before we get into our grand finale, and a couple of things I really want to address. Kicked it all off from the album Toys in the Attic from 1975, Sweet Emotion. Following that was a live version of Come Together, the Beatles cover, and that was recorded at their rehearsal space at the Warehouse in Walton, Massachusetts on August 21st, 1978. The actual studio version was produced by the one and only George Martin, who produced the Beatles. They did it in two takes, which is almost unheard of for Aerosmith. For anyone who actually knows anything about their history. And it was their last top 40 hit for almost 10 years. Yes, wow. Following that was a live radio broadcast on WKRQ in Cincinnati from 1973. Eventually appeared on the box set Pandora's Box. That was Walking the Dog, the old Rufus Thomas cover. Rufus Thomas being a Stax mainstay. And interesting fun fact, because I love interesting fun facts. Rufus Thomas and Steven Tyler have the same birthday. Yes, March 26th. Following that was a live version of What Else Could That Have Been? It took Rolling Stone quite a long time to get around to recognizing just how fantastic Aerosmith were. They did it not once, but twice. The original single version of this appears on their 500 Greatest Songs of All Time, once in its original version, and the other one in a cover with Steven and Joe Perry, Run DMC, Walk This Way. And for those of you who think that their later shows in the 70s might have been spotty, this one is just a smoking version, recorded in, what else, Detroit, Michigan, on April 2nd, 1978, appeared on the album Live Bootleg, Walk This Way, my God. Following that, for those of you who remember our blues program, the 1950s blues, the genesis of it all, from last year, that was originally a cover of Bull Moose Jackson's big 10-inch record from the last song on side one of Toys in the Attic. And for those of you who are unaware, singles weren't always 7-inch on vinyl. They were on hard black 10-inch shellac. And there you have it. And the song we just heard, slightly edited, Last Child, the single edit there from 1976's Rocks. And fantastic song with all sorts of fantastic time signatures. Here is the creepy thing, all right? When I was telling you about ear-splitting intensity, I meant that literally. J. Paul Getty and the ear, all right, are mentioned in this song. John Paul Getty III was living as a bohemian in Rome with his girlfriend. He was a teenager, was kicked out of school, making jewelry, working as a movie extra and as a model. In 1973, he was kidnapped. And you got to remember, his grandfather was at one time the richest man in the world, J. Paul Getty. J. Paul Getty refused to pay the ransom, which was $17 million. So if I'm not mistaken, according to the last inflation, let's see, is it 3.5% from 76 to now? I might be mistaken, but we're just going to run with that. That would have been about $77 million. He refused to pay, and they cut off his grandson's ear and mailed it to them. He eventually negotiated a lower rate with the group who kidnapped the grandson. It was the Italian mob, by the way. And to about $2.2 million, if I'm not mistaken, which would be just under $10 million today. I know. History isn't always pretty, kids. Now, we're going to be finishing up with our, what is an obvious choice, because I've already mentioned the song once in the program, but I want to say this. I want to thank all the people who've dropped me texts and emails and phone calls about what's going on here in Portland. And in spite of, or maybe because of, all the attention we've been getting, and I'm glad that we're getting it, and there are many people who believe that some of the, what they call theatrics, are distracting from the message. The message has always been the message, and the message is people, good people, are standing up to hate, and they're done with the way things are. And that really just comes down to three words: Black Lives Matter. Let's not ever forget this. Black Lives Matter. That is the reason. And because things have gone absolutely crazy with the coronavirus. To all the Chads and Karens out there, for those of you who want to run your mouth about all lives matter, then wear a goddamn mask, for Christ's sakes. All right. I feel better now. And I guess I'm trying to say through things. Happy anniversary, Travis. I hope you've enjoyed this show, because it's been an absolute joy to put it together. Whew, we've had some ups and downs, haven't we? We've had some crazy times, and we're still here. from 1974's Get Your Wings with live overdubs stolen from the Concert for Bangladesh by George Harrison and Friends. This is Train Kept a Rollin'.
Let it go.